You don't want to believe, Artie countered defiantly. Why? Are you afraid? No. I'm just a realist. I think instead of jabbering about a piece of junk. We ought to be finding some more wood for that fire before it goes out. Sister glanced at it. The flames were gnawing away the last of a broken chair. She gently took the glass ring back from Beth. It was hot from the other woman's palms. Maybe the colors and pulsations did trigger pictures in the mind, she thought. She was suddenly reminded of an object from a distant childhood, a glass ball filled with black ink, made to look like a pool table eight ball. You were supposed to make a wish, think about it real hard, and then turn it upside down. At the bottom of the eight ball, a little white polyhedron surfaced, with different things written on each side, such as, "Your wish will be granted." "It's a certainty." "It appears doubtful." And the aggravating, "Ask again later." They were all-purpose answers to the questions of a child who desperately wanted to believe in magic. You could make whatever you wanted to out of those answers, and maybe this was what the glass thing was, too. A cryptic eight-ball that made you see what you wanted to see. Still, she thought, she'd had no desire to go dreamwalking across a burned prairie. The image had just appeared and carried her along. So what was this thing? Cryptic eight-ball or doorway to dreams? Dream food and dream water might be good enough to soothe desire for such things, Sister knew. But they needed the real stuff, plus wood for that fire. And the only place to get any of that was outside, in one of the other houses. She put the glass thing back into her bag.
"I've got to go out," she said. "Maybe I can find us some food and something to drink in the next house. Artie, will you go with me? You can help me break up a chair or whatever for some more wood, okay?"
He nodded. "Okay. I'm not afraid of a little wind and rain." Sister looked at Doyle Halland. His gaze skittered up from the Gucci bag.
"How about you? Will you go with us?"
Halland shrugged. "Why not? But if you and he go in one direction, I ought to go in another. I can look through the house to the right if you go to the one on the left."
"Right. Good idea." She stood up. "We need to find some sheets that we can wrap wood and stuff up in to carry it. I think we'd be safer crawling than walking. If we stay close to the ground, maybe the wind won't be so bad."
Artie and Halland found sheets and clutched them under their arms to keep them from opening like parachutes in the wind. Sister made Beth comfortable and motioned for Julia to stay with her.
"Be careful," Beth said. "It doesn't sound too nice out there."
"We'll be back," Sister promised,
and she went across the room to the front door, which was about the only wooden thing that hadn't gone into the fire. She pushed against the door, and immediately the room was full of cold, spinning wind and icy rain. Sister dropped to her knees and crawled out onto the slick porch, holding her leather bag. The light was the color of graveyard dirt, and the wind-blasted houses around them were as crooked as neglected tombstones. Followed closely by Artie, Sister began to crawl slowly down the front steps to the frosted-over lawn. She looked back, squinting against the stinging whip-strike of ice, and saw Doyle Halland inching toward the house on the right, drawing his injured leg carefully after him. It took them almost 10 freezing minutes to reach the next house. The roof had been torn almost off, and ice coated everything. Artie went to work, finding a crevice in which to tie the sheet into a bag, and then gathering up the shards of timbers that lay everywhere. In the remains of the kitchen, Sister slipped on ice and fell hard on her rear end. But she found some cans of vegetables in the pantry, some frozen apples, onions, and potatoes, and in the refrigerator, some rock-hard TV dinners. All that could be stuffed into her bag went in, and by that time her hands were stiff claws. Lugging her bundle of booty, she found Artie with a bulging sheet bag full of bits and pieces of wood.
"You ready?"
she shouted against the wind, and he nodded that he was. The trip back was more treacherous, because they were holding their treasures so tightly. The wind
thrust against them, even though they crawled on their bellies, and Sister thought that if she didn't get to a fire soon, her hands and face would fall off. Slowly, they covered the territory between houses. There was no sign of Doyle Halland, and Sister knew that if he'd fallen and hurt himself, he could freeze to death. If he didn't return in 5 minutes, she'd have to go looking for him. They crawled up the ice-coated steps to the front porch and through the door into the blessed warmth. When Artie was in, Sister pushed the door shut and latched it. The wind beat and howled outside like something monstrous deprived of playthings. A skin of ice had begun to melt from Sister's face, and little icicles dangled from Artie's earlobes. "We made it!" Artie's jaws were stiff with cold. "We got some..." He stopped speaking. He was staring past Sister, and his eyes with their icy lashes were widening in horror. Sister whirled around. She went cold, colder than she'd been in the storm. Beth Phelps was lying on her back before the guttering fire. Her eyes were open, and a pool of blood was spreading around her head. There was a hideous wound in her temple, as if a knife had been driven right through her brain. One hand was upraised, frozen in the air. "Oh, Jesus!" Artie's hand pressed to his mouth. In a corner of the room, Julia Castillo lay curled up and contorted. Between her sightless eyes, there was a similar wound, and blood had sprayed like a Chinese fan over the wall behind her. Sister clenched her teeth to trap a scream. And then a figure stirred in the corner beyond the fire's faint glow. "Come in," Doyle Halland said. "Excuse the mess." He stood to his full height, his eyes catching a glint of orange light like the reflecting pupils of a cat. "Got your goodies, didn't you?" His voice was lazy, the voice of a man who'd stuffed himself at dinner but couldn't refuse dessert. "I got mine, too."
"My God, my God. What's happened here?"
Artie held on to Sister's arm for support. Doyle Halland lifted a finger into the air and slowly aimed it at Sister.
"I remembered you," he said softly. "You were the woman who came into the theater. The woman with the necklace. See, I met a friend of yours back in the city. He was a policeman. I ran into him while I was wandering." Sister saw his teeth gleam as he grinned, and her knees almost buckled. "We had a nice chat." Jack Tomacek. Jack Tomacek couldn't go through the Holland Tunnel. He'd turn back, and somewhere in the ruins, he'd come face to face with... "He told me some others had gotten out," Doyle Halland continued. "He said one of them was a woman, and do you know what he remembered most about her? That she had a wound on her neck in the shape of... well, you know. He told me she was leading a group of people west." His hand, with the extended finger, jiggled back and forth. "Naughty, naughty. No fair, sneaking when my back's turned."
"You killed them,"
her voice quavered. "I freed them. One of them was dying and the other was half dead." "What did they have to hope for, I mean, really?"
"You followed me. Why?"
"You got out. You were leading others out. That's not very fair, either. You ought to let the dead lie where they fall. But I'm glad I followed you, because you have something that interests me very much." His finger pointed to the floor. "You can put it at my feet now."
"What?"
"You know what. It. The glass thing. Come on. Don't make a scene." He waited. Sister realized she hadn't sensed his cold spore, as she had on 42nd Street and in the theater, because everything was cold. And now here he was, and he wanted the only thing of beauty that remained.
"How did you find me?"
she asked him, trying desperately to think of a way out.
Beyond the latched door at her back, the wind keened and shrieked. I knew if you got through the Holland Tunnel, you'd have to cross Jersey City. I followed the path of least resistance, and I saw your fire. I stood listening to you and watching, and then I found a piece of stained glass, and I realized what the place had been. I found a body, too, and I took the clothes off it. I can make any size fit. See? His shoulders suddenly rippled with muscle, his spine lengthening. The priest's jacket split along the seams. Now he stood about 2 inches taller than he had a second before. Artie moaned, shaking his head from side to side.
I don't understand.
You don't have to, Cupcakes. This is between the lady and me.
What are you?
She resisted the urge to retreat before him because she feared that one backward step would bring him on her like a dark whirlwind.
I'm the winner, he said. And you know what? I didn't even have to work up a sweat. I just laid back and it all came to me.
His grin turned savage. It's party time, lady, and my party's gonna go on for a long, long time. Sister did step back. The Doyle Hallen thing glided forward.
That glass circle is pretty. Do you know what it is?
She shook her head. I don't either, but I know I don't like it.
Why? What's it to you?
He stopped, his eyes narrowing.
It's dangerous. For you, I mean. It gives you false hope. I listened to all that bullshit about beauty and hope and sand a few nights ago. I had to bite my tongue or I would have laughed in your face. Now, tell me you don't really believe in that crap and make my day, won't you?
Yes, Sister said firmly. Her voice only trembled a little bit. I do believe.
I was afraid of that.
Still grinning, he reached down to the metal splinter in his leg. Its point was smeared with gore. He began to draw it out, and Sister knew what had made those wounds. He pulled the dagger free and straightened up. His leg didn't bleed.
Bring it to me, he said in a voice as smooth as black velvet.
Sister's body jerked. The willpower seemed to drain out of her as if her soul had become a sieve. Dazed and floating, she wanted to go to him, wanted to reach into the bag and draw out the circle of glass, wanted to place it in his hand and offer her throat to the dagger. That would be the easy thing to do, and all resistance seemed incredibly, insufferably difficult. Shivering, her eyes round and wet, she winnowed her hand into the bag, past the cans and the hard-frozen TV dinners, and touched the circle. Diamond-white light flared under her fingers. Its brilliance startled her to her senses, the willpower flooding back into her mind. She stiffened her legs as if rooting them to the floor.
Come to Papa, he said.
But there was a tense, rough edge in his voice. He wasn't used to being disobeyed, and he could feel her resisting him. She was tougher by far than the kid in the theater who had resisted about as much as a marshmallow pie against a buzzsaw. He could peer behind her eyes, and he saw leaping shadowy images, a spinning blue light, a rainy highway, the figures of women drifting through dim corridors, the feel of harsh concrete and brutal blows. This woman, he reasoned, had learned to make suffering her companion.
I said, bring it to me now.
And he won. After a few more seconds of struggle, he won as he knew he must. Sister tried to prevent her legs from moving forward, but they continued on as if they might snap off at the knees and keep going without her torso. His voice licked at her senses, drew her steadily onward.
That's right. Come on. Bring it here. Good girl, he said when she got within a few feet.
Behind her, Artie Wisco still cringed near the door.
The Doyle-Hallen thing reached slowly out to take the glowing glass circle. His hand paused inches from touching it. The jewels pulsed rapidly. He cocked his head to one side. Such a thing should not be. He would feel much better about it when it was ground to bits under his shoe. He snatched it from her fingers.
"Thank you,"
he whispered. The ring of glass changed. It happened in an instant. The rainbow lights faded, became murky and ugly, turning swamp mud brown, pus gray, coal mine black. The glass circle did not pulse. It lay dead in his grip.
"Shit,"
he said, amazed and confounded, and one of his gray eyes bleached pale blue. Sister blinked, felt cold chills running down her spine. The blood tingled in her legs again. Her heart labored like an engine straining to kick over after a night in the cold. His attention was directed to the black circle, and she knew she only had a second or two to save her life. She braced her legs and swung the leather bag right at the side of his skull. His head jerked up, his lips twisting into a grimace. He started to juke aside, but the Gucci bag full of cans and frozen dinners hit him with every ounce of strength Sister could summon. She expected him to take it like a stone wall and scream like hellfire, so she was astounded when he grunted and staggered back against the wall as if his bones were made of papier-mâché. Sister's free hand shot out and grabbed the ring, and they held it between them. Something akin to an electric shock rippled through her arm, and she had the mental vision of a face studded with 100 noses and mouths and blinking eyes of all shapes and colors. She thought it must be his true face, a face of masks and changes, tricks and chameleonic evil. Her half of the circle erupted into light, even brighter than before. The other half, in his grasp, remained black and cold. Sister ripped it away from him, and the rest of the ring blossomed into incandescent fire. She saw the Doyle-Hallen thing squint in its glare and throw a hand over his face to avoid the light. Her heartbeat was making the ring pulse wildly, and the creature before her recoiled from that fiery light as if he was stunned by both its strength and her own. She saw what might have been fear in his eyes. But it was only there for an instant, because suddenly his eyes were sucked down into hoods of flesh, his entire face shifting. The nose collapsed, the mouth slithered away. A black eye opened at the center of his forehead, and a green eye blinked on his cheek. A shark-like mouth yawned over the point of the chin, and exposed within the cavity were small yellow fangs.
"Let's party, bitch!"
the mouth howled, and the metal splinter flashed with light as he lifted it over his head to strike. The dagger came down like vengeance. But Sister's bag was there like a shield, and the dagger punched through but couldn't penetrate a frozen turkey dinner. He reached for her throat with his other hand, and what she did next she did from street fighting, down and dirty, ball-kicking experience. She swung the glass circle at his face and buried one of the spikes in the black eye at the center of his forehead. A scream like a cat being skinned came from the gaping mouth, and the Doyle-Hallen thing's head thrashed so quickly that the glass spike broke off, still full of light and embedded in the eye like Ulysses' spear in the orb of the Cyclops. He flailed wildly with his dagger, the other eye rolling in its socket and percolating through the flesh. Sister shouted, "Run!" to Artie Wisco, and then turned and fled herself. He fumbled with the latch and almost took the door with him as he ran from the house. The wind caught him, knocked his legs out from under him. He slid on his belly, still gripping the bag full of wood shards, down the steps to the icy curb. Sister followed him, also lost her balance on the steps, and went down. She shoved the glass ring deep into her bag and crawled along the ice, skimming away from the house on her belly like a human sled. Artie scrabbled after her. And from behind them, tattered by the wind scream, came his maddened roar.
I'll find you. I'll find you, bitch. You can't get away.
She looked back, saw him through the storm. He was trying to pull the black spike out of his eye. And suddenly his feet went out from under him and he fell on the front porch.
I'll find you, he promised, struggling to get up. You can't get up.
The noise of the storm took his voice, and Sister realized she was sliding faster, going downhill over the tea-colored ice. An ice-covered car loomed in front of her. There was no way to avoid it. She scrunched herself down and went under it, something snagging and ripping her fur coat as she shot beneath the car and continued down the incline out of control. She looked back and saw Artie spinning like a saucer, but his course took him around the car and out of danger. They sped down the hill, two human toboggans passing along a street lined with dead and crumpled houses, the wind thrusting them onward and sleet stinging their faces. They would find shelter somewhere, Sister thought. Maybe another house, and they had plenty of food, wood to start a fire. No matches or lighter, but surely the looters and fleeing survivors hadn't carried off everything that would throw a spark. She still had the glass ring. The Doyle Hallen thing had been right. It was hope, and she would never let it go, never. But it was something else, too. Something special. Something, as Beth Phelps had said, magic. But what the purpose of that magic was, she couldn't yet fathom. They were going to live, and they were skidding further and further away from the monster who wore a priest's suit. I'll find you, she heard it bellowing in her mind. I'll find you. And she feared that someday, somehow, it just might. They skidded down to the end of the hill, past more abandoned cars, and continued along the thoroughfare about 40 more yards before they bumped the curb. Their ride was over, but their journey had just begun. Chapter 28. Time passed. Josh judged its passage by the number of empty cans that were piling up in what he thought of as the city dump, that foul area over in the far corner where they both used the bathroom and tossed the empties. They went through one can of vegetables every other day, and one can of meat product, like Spam or corned beef, on alternating days. The way Josh calculated the passage of a day was by his bowel movements. He'd always been as regular as clockwork, so the trips to the city dump and the pile of empties gave him a reasonable estimation of time. And he figured, now, that they'd been in the basement between 19 and 23 days, which would make it anywhere between the 5th and 13th of August. Of course, there was no telling how long they'd been there before they'd gotten semi-organized either, so Josh thought it was probably closer to the 17th, and that would mean 1 month had passed. He found a packet of flashlight batteries in the dirt, so they were okay on that account. The light showed him that they'd passed the halfway point of their food supply. It was time to start digging. As he gathered up the shovel and pickaxe, he heard their gopher scrambling happily amid the city dump's cans. The little beast thrived on their leftovers, which didn't amount to much, and licked the can so clean you could see her face reflected on the bottom, which was something Josh definitely avoided doing. Swan was asleep, breathing quietly in the darkness. She slept a lot, and Josh figured that was good. She was saving her energy, hibernating like a little animal. Yet when Josh woke her, she came up instantly, focused and alert. He slept a few feet away from her, and it amazed him how attuned he'd become to the sound of her breathing. Usually it was deep and slow, the sound of oblivion. But sometimes it was fast and ragged, the gasp of memories, bad dreams, the sinking in of realities. It was that sound that awakened Josh from his own uneasy sleep, and often he heard Swan call for her mother or make a garbled utterance of terror, as if something was stalking her across the wasteland of nightmares. They'd had plenty of time to talk.
She told him about her mother and uncles and how much she enjoyed planting her gardens. Josh had asked her about her father. She'd said he was a rock musician, but hadn't offered anything else. She'd ask him what it felt like to be a giant, and he'd told her he'd be a rich man if he had a quarter for every time he'd bumped his head at the top of a doorway. Also, it was tough finding clothes big enough, though he didn't tell her that he'd already noticed his waistband was loosening, and that his shoes were specially made. "So, I guess it's expensive to be a giant," he'd said. "Otherwise, I guess I'm about the same as everybody else." In telling her about Rose and the boys, he tried very hard not to let his voice break. He could have been talking about strangers, people he knew only as pictures in somebody else's wallet. He told Swan about his football days, how he'd been most valuable player in 3 games. Wrestling wasn't so bad, he'd told her. It was honest money, and a man as big as he couldn't do much else that was legal. The world was too small for giants. It built doorways too low, furniture too flimsy, and there wasn't a mattress made that didn't pop and squall when he lay down to rest. During the times they talked, Josh kept the flashlight off. He didn't want to see the child's blistered face and stubble of hair and remember how pretty she'd been. And also, he wanted to spare her the sight of his own repellent mug. Pawpaw Briggs's ashes were buried. They didn't talk about that at all, but the command, "protect the child," remained in Josh's mind like the tolling of an iron bell. He switched on the flashlight. Swan was curled up in her usual place, sleeping soundly. The dried fluids of burst blisters glistened on her face. Flaps of skin were dangling from her forehead and cheeks like thin layers of flaking paint, and underneath them, the raw scarlet flesh was growing fresh blisters. He gently prodded her shoulder, and her eyes immediately opened. They were bloodshot, the lashes gummy and yellow, her pupils shrinking to pinpoints. He moved the light away from her.
"Time to wake up. We're gonna start digging."
She nodded and sat up.
"If we both work, it'll be faster," he said. "I'm gonna start with a pickaxe, then I'd like you to shovel away the loose dirt, okay?"
"Okay," she replied, and she got on her hands and knees to follow him. Josh was about to crawl over to the gopher hole when he noticed something in the spill of light that he'd not seen before. He shifted the beam back to where she'd been sleeping.
"Swan, what is that?"
"Where?"
Her gaze moved along the light. Josh put aside the shovel and pickaxe and reached down. Where Swan customarily slept were hundreds of tiny emerald green blades of grass. They formed a perfect image of a child's curled-up body. He touched the grass. Not exactly grass, he realized. Shoots of some kind. Tiny shoots of... were they new corn stalks? He shone the light around. The soft, down-like vegetation was growing in no other place but where Swan slept. He plucked up a bit of it to examine the roots, and he noted that Swan flinched.
"What's wrong?"
"I don't like that sound."
"Sound? What sound?"
"A hurting sound," she answered.
Josh didn't know what she was talking about, and he shook his head. The roots trailed down about 2 inches, delicate filaments of life. They'd obviously been growing there for some time, but Josh couldn't understand how the shoots had rooted in tainted dirt without a drop of water. It was the only bit of green life he'd seen since they'd been trapped here. But there had to be a simple explanation, he figured, that the whirlwind had carried seeds in and somehow they'd rooted and popped up, that's all. Right, he thought. Rooted without water and popped up without an iota of sunlight, that made about as much sense as Pawpaw deciding to emulate a Roman candle. He let the green shoots drift down again. At once, Swan picked up a handful of loose dirt, worked it between her fingers for a few seconds with single-minded interest, and covered the shoots over. Josh leaned back, his knees up against his chest.
"It's only growing where you lie down to sleep. It's kind of peculiar, don't you think?"
She shrugged.
She could feel him watching her carefully.
"You said you heard a sound," he continued. "What kind of sound was it?"
Again, a shrug. She didn't know how to talk about it. Nobody had ever asked her such things before.
"Now, I didn't hear anything," Josh said, and he reached toward the chutes again.
She grasped his hand before he got there. "Like I said, a hurting sound. I don't know exactly."
"When I plucked them up?"
"Yes."
"Lord," Josh thought, "I'm just about ready for a rubber room." He'd been thinking as he looked at the pattern of green in the dirt that they were growing there because her body made them grow, her chemistry or something reacting with the earth. It was a crazy idea, but there they were.
"What's it like? A voice?"
"No, not like that."
"I'd like to hear about it."
"Really?"
"Yes," Josh said. "Really?"
"My mama said it was imagination."
"Is it?"
She hesitated, and then she said firmly, "No." Her fingers touched the new shoots tenderly, barely grazing them. "One time my mama took me to a club to hear the band. Uncle Warren was playing the drums. I heard a noise like the hurting sound, and I asked her what made it. She said it was a steel guitar, the kind you put on your lap and play. But there are other things in the hurting sound, too." Her eyes found his. "Like the wind, or a train's whistle way far off, or thunder long before you see the lightning. A lot of things."
"How long have you been able to hear it?"
"Since I was a little girl." Josh couldn't help but smile. Swan misread it. "Are you making fun of me?"
"No. Maybe. I wish I could hear a sound like that. Do you know what it is?"
"Yes,"
Swan answered.
"It's death."
His smile faltered and went away.
Swan picked up some dirt and slowly worked it, feeling its dry, brittle texture. "In the summer, it's the worst. That's when people bring their lawnmowers out."
"But it's just grass," Josh said.
"In the fall, the hurting sounds different," she continued, as if she hadn't heard them. "It's like a great big sigh. And then the leaves come down. Then in winter, the hurting sound stops and everything sleeps." She took nuggets of dirt from her palm, mixed them with the rest. "When it starts getting warm again, the sun makes things think about waking up."
"Think about waking up?"
"Everything can think and feel in its own way," she replied, and she looked up at him. The eyes in her young face were very old, Josh thought. "Bugs, birds, even grass, everything has its own way of speaking and knowing. Just depends on whether you can understand it or not."
Josh grunted. "Bugs," she'd said.
He was remembering the swarm of locusts that had whirled through his Pontiac the day of the blast. He'd never thought before about the things she was saying, but he realized there was truth to it. Birds knew to migrate when the clock of seasons changed. Ants built anthills in a frenzy of communication. Flowers bloomed and withered, but their pollen lived on, all according to a great mysterious schedule that he'd always taken for granted.
It was as simple as grass growing and as complex as a firefly's light.
"Now, how do you know these things?" he asked. "Who taught you?"
"Nobody. I just figured it out." She recalled her first garden, growing from a sandbox at a nursery school playground. It had been years before she found out that holding earth didn't make everybody's hands tingle with a pins and needles sensation, or that everybody couldn't tell from its buzz whether a wasp wanted to sting or just investigate your ear. She'd always known, and that was that.
"Oh," he said.
He watched her rubbing the dirt in her hands. Swan's palms were tingling, her hands warm and moist. He looked at the green shoots again.
"I'm just a wrestler," he said very quietly. "That's all. I mean, damn, I'm just a nobody."
Protect the child, he thought. Protect her from what, from whom, and why?
"What the hell?" he whispered, have I got myself into? Huh? She asked. Nothing, he said. Her eyes were those of a little girl again, and she mixed the rest of the warm dirt into the ground around the chutes.
We'd better start digging now. Are you up to it?
Yes.
She grasped the shovel he'd laid aside. The tingling, glowing sensation was slowly ebbing away. But he wasn't ready, not just yet.
Swan, listen to me for a minute. I want to be truthful with you, because I think you can handle it. We're going to try to get out of here, but that's not saying we can. We'll have to dig a pretty wide tunnel to squeeze my blubber through. It's going to take us some time, and it sure as hell won't be easy work. If it caves in, we'll have to start all over again. What I'm saying, I guess, is that I'm not sure we can get out. I'm not sure at all. Do you understand?
She nodded, said nothing. And one more thing, he added.
If, when, we get out, we might not like what we find. Everything might be changed. It might be like waking up after the worst nightmare you can think of and finding that the nightmare followed you into daylight. Understand?
Again, Swan nodded. She'd already thought about what he was saying because no one had ever come to get them out like her mama had said. She put on her most grown-up face and waited for him to make the next move.
Okay, Josh said. Let's start digging.
Chapter 29 Josh Hutchins stared, squinted, and blinked.
Light, he said, the walls of the tunnel pressing against his shoulders and back. I see light.
Behind him, about 30 feet away in the basement, Swan called,
How far is it?
She was utterly filthy, and there seemed to be so much dirt up her nostrils that they might sprout gardens, too. The thought had made her giggle a few times, a sound she'd never believed she'd make again.
Maybe 10 or 12 feet, he answered.
And he continued digging with his hands and pushing the dirt behind him, then pushing it further back with his feet. The pickaxe and shovel approach had been a valiant effort, but after 3 days of working, they'd realized the best tools were their hands. Now, as he squeezed his shoulders forward to grab more dirt, Josh looked at the weak red glimmer way up at the gopher hole's entrance and thought it was the most beautiful light he'd ever seen. Swan entered the tunnel behind him and scooped the loose dirt up in a large can, carrying it back to the basement to empty over the slit trench. Her hands, arms, face, nostrils, and knees, everything that was covered with dirt, tingled all the way down to her bones. She felt like she had a flame burning in her backbone. Across the basement, the young green shoots were 4 inches tall. Josh's face was plastered with dirt, even his teeth were gritty with it. The soil was heavy with a thick, gummy consistency, and he had to stop to rest.
Josh, you all right?
Swan asked.
Yeah. Just need a minute to get my wind.
His shoulders and forearms ached mercilessly, and the last time he'd been so weary was after a 10-man battle royale in Chattanooga. The light seemed further away than he'd first reckoned, as if the tunnel, which they'd both come to love and hate, was elongating, playing a cruel trick of perception. He felt as if he'd crawled into one of those Chinese tubes that lock your fingers, one stuck into each end, except his whole body was jammed tight as a monk's jockstrap. He started again, bringing a double handful of the heavy earth back and underneath him as if he were swimming through dirt. My mama raised herself a gopher, he thought, and he had to grin despite his weariness. His mouth tasted like he'd been dining on mud pies. 6 more inches dug away. 1 more foot. Was the light closer or further away? He pushed himself onward, thinking about how his mama used to scold him for not scrubbing behind his ears. 1 foot, and another. Behind him, Swan crawled in and carried the loose dirt out again and again, like clockwork. The light was getting closer now, he was sure of it. But now it wasn't so beautiful. Now it was sickly, not like sunlight at all. Diseased, Josh thought, and maybe deadly, too. But he kept going, one double handful after the next, inching slowly toward the outside world. Dirt suddenly plopped down on the back of his neck. He lay still, expecting a cave-in, but the tunnel held. "For God's sake, don't stop now," he told himself, and he reached out for the next handful. "I'm almost there," he shouted, but the earth muffled his voice. He didn't know if Swan had heard or not. "Just a few more feet." But just short of the opening, which was not quite as large as Josh's fist, he had to stop and rest again. Josh lay staring longingly at the light, the hole about 3 feet away. He could smell the outside now, the bitter aromas of burned earth, scorched corn stalks, and alkali. Rousing himself, he pushed onward. The earth was tougher near the surface, full of glazed stones and metallic lumps. The fire had burned the dirt into something resembling pavement. Still, he strained upward, his shoulders throbbing, his gaze fixed on the hole of ugly light. And then he was close enough to thrust his hand through it. But before he tried, he said, "I'm there, Swan. I'm at the top." He clawed away dirt, and his hand reached the hole, but the underside of the surface around it felt like pebbled asphalt, and he couldn't get his fingers through. He balled up his fist, the flesh mottled gray and white, and pushed. Harder, harder still. "Come on, come on," he thought. "Push, damn it." There was a dry, stubborn, cracking sound. At first, Josh thought it was his arm breaking, but he felt no pain, and he kept pushing as if trying to punch the sky. The earth cracked again. The hole began to crumble and widen. His fist started going through, and he envisioned what it might look like to someone standing on the surface, the blossoming of a zebra-blotched fist like a strange new flower through the dead earth, the fist opening and fingers stretching petal-like under the weak red light. Josh shoved his arm through almost to the elbow. Cold wind snapped at his fingertips. That movement of air exhilarated him, jarred him as if from a long somnolence.
"We're out," he shouted, about to sob with joy. "Swan, we're out."
She was behind him, crouched in the tunnel.
"Can you see anything?"
"I'm going to put my head through," he told her. "Here goes."
He pushed upward, his shoulder following his arm, breaking the hole wider. Then his entire arm was out, and the top of his head was ready to press through. As he pushed, he thought of watching his sons being born, their heads straining to enter the world. He felt as giddy and afraid as any infant could possibly be. Behind him, Swan was pushing at him too, giving him support as he stretched to break free. The earth parted with a sound like baked clay snapping apart. With a surge of effort, Josh thrust his head through the opening and into a biting, turbulent wind.
"Are you there yet?"
Swan asked.
"What can you see?"
Josh narrowed his eyes, his hand up to ward off flying grit. He saw a desolate, grayish-brown landscape, featureless except for what appeared to be the mangled remnants of the Bonneville and Darlene's Camaro. Overhead was a low sky plated with thick gray clouds. From dead horizon to dead horizon, the clouds were slowly, ponderously rotating, and here and there were quicksilver glints of harsher scarlet. Josh looked over his shoulder. About 15 feet behind him and to his left was a large dome of dirt, mashed down corn stalks, pieces of wood and metal from the gas pumps and cars. He realized it was the grave they'd been buried in, and at the same time he knew that if the tons of cornfield dirt hadn't sealed them in, they would have been burned to death. Other than that, and a few drifts of corn stalks and debris, the land was scraped clean. The wind was blowing into his face. He crawled up out of the hole and sat on his haunches, looking around at the destruction while Swan emerged from the tunnel.
The cold sliced to her bones, and her bloodshot eyes moved incredulously over what had become a desert.
"Oh,"
she whispered, but the wind stole her voice.
"Everything's gone."
Josh hadn't heard her. He couldn't get any sense of direction. He knew the nearest town, or what was left of it, was Selena, but which direction was east and which west? Where was the sun? Flying grit and dust obscured everything beyond 20 yards or so. Where was the highway?
"There's nothing left," Josh said, mostly to himself. "There's not a damned thing left."
Swan saw a familiar object lying nearby. She stood up and walked with an effort against the wind to the small figure. Most of the blue fur had been burned off of it, but its plastic eyes with the little black rolling pupils were intact. Swan reached down and picked it up. The cord with its pull ring dangled from the doll's back. She yanked it and heard the cookie monster ask for more cookies in a slow, distorted voice. Josh rose to his feet.
"Well," he thought, "now we're out. Now what the hell do we do? Where do we go?"
He shook his head in disgust.
Maybe there was nowhere to go. Maybe everything everywhere was just like this. What was the point of leaving their basement?
He looked grimly at the hole they'd just crawled from, and he thought for a moment of shimmying back down there like a big gopher and spending the rest of his days licking out cans and shitting in a slit trench.
"Careful," he warned himself, because that hole back to the basement, back to the grave, was suddenly too appealing. Much, much too appealing.
He stepped away from the hole a few paces and tried to think coherently. His gaze slid toward the child. She was covered with tunnel dirt, her ragged clothes flapping around her. She stared into the distance, her eyes narrowed against the wind with that dumb doll cradled in her arms. Josh looked at her for a long time.
"I could do it," he told himself. "Sure. I could make myself do it, because it would be the right thing. Might be the right thing. Wouldn't it? If everything is like this, what's the damn point of living, right?" Josh opened his hands, closed them again. "I could make it quick," he thought. "She'd never feel a thing. And then I could just mosey over to that junk pile and find a nice piece of metal with a sharp edge and finish the job on myself, too. That would be the right thing to do, wouldn't it? Protect the child," he thought. And a deep, terrible shame stabbed him. Some protection, he thought. But Jesus Christ, everything's gone. Everything's been blown to hell.
Swan turned her head and her eyes sought his. She said something, but he couldn't understand her. She walked closer to him, shivering and bowed against the wind, and she shouted,
"What are we going to do?"
"I don't know," he shouted back.
"It's not like this everywhere, is it?"
she asked him.
"There must be other people somewhere. There must be towns and people."
"Maybe, maybe not. Damn, it's cold," he trembled. He'd been dressed for a hot July day, and now he hardly had a shirt on.
"We can't just stand here," Swan said. "We've got to go somewhere."
"Right. Well, take your choice of directions, little lady. They all look the same to me."
Swan stared at him for a few seconds more, and again Josh felt shamed. Then she turned in all directions as if trying to choose one. Suddenly, her eyes filled with tears, and they stung so much she almost screamed. But she bit her lower lip, bit it until it almost bled. She had wished for a moment that her mama was at her side to help her and tell her what to do. She needed her mama to guide her, now more than ever. It wasn't fair that her mama was gone. It wasn't kind, and it wasn't right. But that was thinking like a little girl, she decided. Her mama had gone home to a peaceful place far from this, and Swan had to make some decisions for herself, starting right now. Swan lifted her hand and pointed away from the source of the wind.
"That way," she decided.
Any particular reason?
Yes.
She turned and gave him a look that made him feel like the stupidest clown on earth.
Because the wind'll be at our backs, it'll push us, and walking won't be as hard.
Oh, Josh said meekly. In the distance she'd pointed out was nothing, just swirling dust and utter desolation. He couldn't see the reason in making his legs move. Swan sensed he was ready to sit down, and when he did that, there was no way she could pry his giant butt up again.
"We worked hard to get out of there, didn't we?"
she shouted to him over the wind. He nodded.
"We proved we could do something if we really wanted to, didn't we? You and me? Kinda like a team? We worked hard, and we shouldn't ought to stop working hard now."
He nodded dully.
"We've got to try," Swan shouted.
Josh looked down at the hole again. At least it was warm down there. At least they'd had food. What was so wrong with He sensed movement from the corner of his eye. The little girl, Cookie Monster doll in arms, had begun to walk off in the direction she'd chosen, the wind pushing her along.
"Hey!" Josh yelled.
Swan didn't stop or slow down.
"Hey!"
She kept going. Josh took the first step after her. The wind hit him behind his knees. A clip, 15 yards penalty, he thought, and then caught him in the small of the back, staggering him forward. He took a second step, then a third and a fourth, and then he was following her, but the wind was so strong at his back that it seemed more like flying than walking. He caught up with her, walking a few yards off to the side, and again Josh felt a pang of shame at his weakness, because she didn't even grace him with a glance. She was walking with her chin uplifted, as if in defiance of the bleakness that faced them. Josh thought that she looked like the little queen of a realm that had been stolen from her, a tragic and determined figure. There's nothing out there, Swan thought. A deep, terrible sadness wrenched at her, and if the wind hadn't been pushing so hard, she might have crumpled to her knees. It's all gone. All gone. Two tears ran through the crusted dirt and blisters on her face. Everything can't be gone, she told herself. There have to be towns and people left somewhere. Maybe a mile ahead, maybe two, just through the dust and over the horizon. She kept going, step after step, and Josh Hutchins walked at her side. Behind them, the gopher popped his head out of the crater and looked in all directions. Then he made a little chattering sound and disappeared again into the safety of the earth. Chapter 30. Two figures trudged slowly along Interstate 80 with the snow-covered Pocono Mountains of eastern Pennsylvania at their backs. The fallen snow was dirty gray, and from it protruded rough rocks like warts growing in leprous flesh. New gray snow was tumbling from the sullen, sickly green and sunless sky, and it hissed softly amid the thousands of leafless black hickories, elms, and oaks. The evergreens had turned brown and were losing their needles. From horizon to horizon, as far as Sister and Artie could see, there was no green vegetation, not a green vine or leaf. The wind whipped past them, blowing the ashy snow into their faces. Both of them were bundled up with layers of clothes they'd been able to scavenge in the 21 days since they'd escaped from the monster that called itself Doyle Halland. They'd found a looted Sears department store on the outskirts of Paterson, New Jersey, but almost everything had been carried out of it except for some merchandise at the back, under a big sign with painted icicles that read, "Winter in July Sale. Save the Sears Way." The racks and tables had been untouched, and they yielded up heavy herringbone overcoats, plaid mufflers, wool caps, and gloves lined with rabbit fur. There was even thermal underwear and a supply of boots, which Artie praised as being high-quality merchandise. Now, after more than 100 miles, the boots were supple, but their feet were bloody, wrapped in rags and newspapers after their socks had fallen apart.
Both of them carried knapsacks on their backs, laden with other scavenged objects, cans of food, a can opener, a couple of sharp all-purpose knives, some kitchen matches, a flashlight and extra batteries, and the lucky find of a six-pack of Olympia beer. Around her shoulder as well, Sister supported a dark green duffel bag from the Patterson Army Navy surplus store, which had taken the place of the smaller Gucci bag and held a thermal blanket, some bottles of Perrier, and a few items of packaged cold cuts found in an almost empty grocery store. At the bottom of the duffel bag was the glass circle, placed so Sister could feel it through the canvas whenever she wanted to. A red plaid muffler and an electric green woolen cap protected Sister's face and head from the wind, and she was wrapped in a woolen coat over two sweaters. Baggy brown corduroy pants and leather gloves completed her wardrobe, and she moved slowly through the snow with the weight that pressed on her, but at least she was warm. Artie, too, was burdened with a heavy coat, a blue muffler, and two caps, one over the other. Only the area around their eyes was exposed to the blowing snow, the flesh raw and wind-burned. The gray, ugly snow swirled about them, the interstate pavement was covered to a depth of about 4 inches, and higher drifts grew amid the denuded forest and deep ravines on either side. Walking a few yards in front of Artie, Sister lifted her hand and pointed to the right. She trudged over to four dark clumps lying in the snow, and she peered down at the frozen corpses of a man, a woman, and two children. All were wearing summer clothes, short-sleeved shirts and light pants. The man and woman had died holding hands, except the third finger of the woman's left hand had been chopped off. Her wedding ring, Sister thought. Somebody had cut the whole finger off to get it. The man's shoes were gone, and his feet were black. His sunken eyes glistened with gray ice. Sister turned away. Since crossing over into Pennsylvania, passing a big green sign that said, "Welcome to Pennsylvania, the Keystone State," about 30 miles and 7 days ago, they'd found almost 300 frozen bodies on Interstate 80. They'd sheltered for a while in a town called Stroudsburg, which had been decimated by a tornado. The houses and buildings lay scattered under the filthy snow like the broken toys of a mad giant, and there'd been plenty of corpses, too. Sister and Artie had found a pickup truck, the tank drained of gas, on the town's main thoroughfare, and had slept in the cab. Then it was back onto the interstate again, heading west in their supple, blood-filled boots. Passing more carnage, wrecked cars and overturned trailers that must have been caught in a crush of traffic fleeing westward. The going was rough. They could make, at the most, 5 miles a day before they had to find shelter. The remnants of a house, a barn, a wrecked car, anything to hold back the wind. In 21 days of traveling, they'd seen only 3 other living people. 2 of those were raving mad, and the third had fled wildly into the woods when he'd seen them coming. Both Sister and Artie had been sick for a while, had coughed and thrown up blood and suffered splitting headaches. Sister had thought she was going to die, and they slept huddled together, each of them breathing like a bellows. But the worst of the sickness and weak, feverish dizziness had gone. And though they both sometimes still coughed uncontrollably and vomited up a little blood, their strength had returned, and they had no more headaches. They left the 4 corpses behind and soon came to the wreckage of an exploded Airstream trailer. A scorched Cadillac had smashed into it, and a Subaru had rear-ended the caddy. Nearby, 2 other vehicles had locked and burned. Further on, another group of people lay where they'd frozen to death, their bodies curled around one another in a vain search for warmth. Sister passed them without pausing. The face of death was no stranger to her now, but she couldn't stand to look too closely. About 50 yards further, Sister stopped abruptly. Just ahead of her, through the tumbling snow, an animal was gnawing at one of 2 corpses that lay against the right-hand guardrail. The thing looked up and tensed. It was a large dog, Sister saw, maybe a wolf, come down from the mountains to feed. The beast was about the size of a German shepherd, with a long snout and a reddish-gray hide. It had chewed a leg down to the bone, and now it crouched over its prize and stared menacingly at Sister. "If that bastard wants fresh meat, we're dead," she thought. She stared back at the thing,